Hello, everyone. It's Tom Slater here, editor of Spiked. Now, before you skip ahead of this bit, this preamble, plug-heavy section of the podcast, stop for a second because we've got a very exciting announcement for you today. And that is that we're delighted to announce the upcoming publication of Brendan O'Neill's brilliant new book. It's called A Heretic's Manifesto. It's out on the 5th of June, and I really think you're going to like it. It's a blast against the conformity of our age, covering everything from gender to COVID to climate change and much else besides. You can pre-order it right now on Amazon UK and Amazon US, or if you'd like a signed copy, we've got a very special offer on at the moment. So for a limited time only, anyone who donates £50 or more to Spiked will get a signed copy of the book in the post. Once again, that's while stocks last, so get yours before they're gone. To do so, just go to spiked-online.com/donate. Plus, if you're a Spiked supporter, don't miss our online book launch, which is taking place on publication day on the 5th of June. Andrew Doyle will be interviewing Brendan about the book and also taking your questions. So if you're a Spiked supporter, that's not to be missed. You can sign up right now on the online hub for free. So whether you're pre-ordering the book or donating to get your signed copy, don't delay. Go and get your copy of A Heretic's Manifesto today. Thanks so much. We hope you enjoy the book. And now, on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, the Spiked podcast all about freedom and the nanny state. In this episode, we discuss the fight for free speech on campus, Keir Starmer's miserable smoking ban, and whether artificial sweeteners are making us fat. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Tom.
And we're delighted to be joined today by Jan McVarish from the Free Speech Union. How are you doing, Jan?
All right, thanks.
So we're going to talk about a lot today. But first of all, I want to talk about freedom of speech on campus, which we haven't touched on for a while. But there's been this big flashpoint story, Jan, in recent weeks around Kathleen Stock. Many people will remember her as the gender-critical philosopher hounded out of a job at the University of Sussex. Become a kind of core celeb in the free speech wars, I think it's fair to say. But in recent weeks, there's been a lot of agitation at Oxford in particular because of the Oxford Union, the debating society, inviting her to speak at the end of the month. And this causing a lot of consternation amongst the LGBTQ student society, who put pressure on the students' union. The students' union were at one point banning the Oxford Union from their freshers' fair, breaking ties and so on. So it's a bit of a complicated picture, but the story is kind of the same of gender-critical woman shows up on campus and gets a hell of a time as a consequence of it. Jan, do you want to tell us a little bit more about this? Because I know that the Free Speech Union have been quite involved in this particular case.
Yeah, so it's moved really fast, actually, and it looks as though it's been resolved today, thankfully. But as you say, Kathleen was due to speak at the Oxford Union at the end of this month. Other speakers that they're due to speak, I noticed, were Emily Thornberry, Michel Barnier. I've not noticed anybody
much more offensive people
complaining against those two. But initially, the Oxford University LGBTQ plus, I'm only saying that once, society objected, saying that they were dismayed and appalled that Kathleen Stock had been invited to speak and that she was a transphobic and trans-exclusionary speaker. And it's interesting the way in which they couched their objection, which was that they accused the Oxford Union of disregarding the welfare of its LGBTQ plus members under the guise of free speech. So I just think that's really interesting, mm-hmm. The suggestion is that free speech is somehow only ever just a kind of a subterfuge or a tool for some other kind of nefarious purpose, which in this case would be to somehow harm LGBTQ plus students. That was then followed by other junior common room associations of students at other colleges calling for the invitation to be rescinded. And then the Oxford University Student Union, as distinct from the Oxford Union Debating Society, they passed a motion which they claimed had nothing to do with Kathleen Stock's invitation. That was after they were put under a degree of pressure from outside. And that motion would sever ties with the Oxford Union, which is a 200-year-old society. You know, it obviously had all the great and the good and the not so good speaking at it over the years. And it would also effectively exclude the Oxford Union from the Freshers' Fair, which is where they meet most of their new members and then get subs, et cetera, so that people can, so that the society can keep going. So it was a very direct attack on the Oxford Union's ability to operate as part of Oxford University. And the grounds on which they said that they wanted to sort of excommunicate the Oxford Union was that they had a toxic culture of bullying and harassment, which is, again, becoming quite a familiar refrain when it comes to attempts to suppress ideas or speech. And so the Free Speech Union wrote to the university and pointed out that if this were to proceed and that the Oxford Union were to be excommunicated from the student union's parameters, then that would be in breach of the university's own freedom of speech policy and its code of practice when it comes to meetings and events. And in that regard, we were citing the 1986 and 1994 Education Acts, so long-standing law. I've just pointed out that under the new Freedom of Speech Act, which was passed last week, the student union itself would be liable for upholding freedom of speech. This is one of the great kind of innovations of this new piece of legislation, which is that the universities and the student unions can be held liable by individuals whose speech has been suppressed. So. What then happened was, so we sent our letter, and there's also then been a letter from 40 Oxford academics, which is a really positive move because that, you know, when Kathleen Stock was effectively hounded out of Sussex, there was zero support mm-hmm. from fellow academics there or anywhere else, really. So that's a good thing, and that's because Oxford academics have been starting to mobilise and they're pre-prepared to kind of respond to these kinds of events. And then I noticed today that Richard Dawkins was sharing a letter that students mm-hmm. could sign. But in the meantime, one of the pro-vice-chancellors of Oxford has written to the Telegraph to confirm that free speech will be upheld at Oxford and that they do not allow the no-platforming of any lawful speech. And said that he'd reminded the Students' Union mm-hmm. of the university's free speech policies. So that's all pretty good. And I think it sounds as though the Student Union has now backed away from its own motion.
What kind of hateful and bigoted things does Kathleen Stock say?
Well, I mean, if you read her book, it's an incredibly careful and considered argument and exploration of the origins of this idea that somehow people can change sex. And she's, you know, she explores the ramifications of the Gender Recognition Act. And, you know, the most prominent thing for me that was really useful was this she argues that the law that was brought in order to protect trans people and to grant them certain special rights was essentially a legal fiction, by which she means that in legal terms, people who claim to be needing to live in the opposite sex or as the opposite sex could be granted the right to do so and to pass as such in certain situations. But that didn't say that they had to pass that as such in every single situation and that they literally were the opposite of what they were born as. And so for that exploration, really, I mean, that's what she was. It was for the book and for her kind of subsequent.
And she's a very sort of mild-mannered, calm sort of reason. She's not a sort of particularly outrageous character, but it is interesting how she's become one of the focuses for this, especially when you think about the Oxford Union and its history, which for those people who don't know, as you say, is a separate debating society. It had often courted controversy and speakers who I think are much more genuinely controversial. Mm-hmm. So, you know, O.J. Simpson had spoken there, you know, post-trial. David Irving spoke there. Nick Griffin spoke there. James Blunt, all of these kind of really outrageous sort of characters. And yet there would always be protests. I mean, time and again, back in 2007, I think, was when Nick Griffin and David Irving were there. Huge protests from the student body calling for them to be no-platformed. But the difference here with the Students' Union kind of making this much more extreme step of saying, we're going to break ties over this. I know they claim that that's not the case, and it was because of this broader toxic culture. Mm. That they disagree with. It does seem to point to the fact that for whatever reason, gender critical feminists wanting to hold on to the view that is secretly held by the vast majority, but never likes to be accepted as such on campus, that biological sex is real and should have certain consequences thereof. What is it about this particular ideology that seems to needle these kind of intolerant campaigns so much, do you think?
I don't know. I'm brewing a theory that there's something to do with mothers going on here. There's some kind of, you know, a sort of final pulling down of maternal authority. It's almost like this is, you know, I've been thinking about it for a while, but, you know, it's almost like paternal authority has already been done away with in effect from the 60s onwards, and that maybe this is the point at which maternal authority is undermined. And I do think the way in which it's caught the imagination of the young, just or some of the young, just as they're leaving home and leaving mummy, or, you know, a kind of rebelling within the family by saying to their mothers, I'm not who you think you brought into the world. There's some, I don't know, I'm not a psychotherapist, but I think there's something weird going on there. And the fact that it's women who attract the ire of these kinds of protesters, not exclusively, but the sort of, just the vitriol.
100%.
And this, the ability to cast women as dangerous, I do think is really quite phenomenal. And, you know, and Kathleen Stock, yes, I mean, just the most reasonable person, you know, bothers to write a book about an important social issue. She doesn't just kind of, you know, I don't know, not that there's anything wrong with taking to the streets or anything else about these issues, but, you know, she takes it seriously, writes a book, much like Helen Joyce did, who was protested at Cambridge when she tried to speak there. So there's something very peculiar. I don't think there have been any male academics who've attracted the same kind of response. And internationally, this is a phenomenon of turning against women. It's Holly Lawford Smith in Australia. And, you know, I find it very difficult to explain. And I do. I mean, it is a very peculiar thing. So I've been down to Hyde Park a few times to Speaker's Corner to see Posy Parker speak and her gatherings. And it did really strike me that, you know, that women and other people are gathering by a tree in order to say men are women, men are men and women are women, and there are issues if we start to blur that boundary. And that's all that's being said, and various explorations of what might happen if we blur that boundary. And yet they have to meet by a tree because you can't actually meet in a building. I mean, it is phenomenal, really phenomenal. And so I am really pleased that it looks as though Kathleen's talk will go ahead. However, you know, the students, I suspect they will still mobilise, which is what just seems to happen with these incredibly noisy protests, where they seek to drown out the speech that has been permitted to happen.
Chris, what's your response, especially why this issue, any other? Because I think that's definitely the case now.
Well, I think what you say there may well be right. There might be something deep and psychological going on amongst some of these people. I just tend to think of it as being like these progressive types have won every single other battle, and this is just the next one. And so they've got to press on. You know, there's this idea being put around that, you know, there isn't a sort of left-wing or progressive or liberal culture, liberal in quote marks, you know, culture. And Matthew Goodwin's got in a lot of scrapes of people recently saying that, you know, the elite of Britain might be a bit left wing, you know. And people come out and say, oh, it's absolutely ridiculous about the Tory government 13 years and so on. But the very fact that this issue is like now the big thing that's being discussed and debated, and the balance of opinion is generally on the side of a man is not a man and a woman is not a woman, shows how massively the progressives have won every single battle. You wouldn't be fighting this if you still had proper battles to fight. Do you know what I mean? This isn't a campaign. This is a victory lap, really. Do you know, if you're talking about, yeah, the big controversies of the day are whether or not you should sort of mutilate children to, you know, because they, you know, they act a bit camp or something. You know, it seems to me that this is proof of the total victory of mad progressive ideas. The other thing is, and this might sound like a bit of a digression, but I was looking at the Eurovision winners, historic Eurovision winners the other day, because I was looking to bet on it because I was forced to watch it. And I realized that do you remember Dana International?
Yep.
It's 25 years ago, that Dana International.
Is it Israeli?
Really?
Eurovision?
Israeli, yeah. Trans woman, right? Yeah. No, no, not the bearded one. No, that was later. No, this was the
way back when.
Way back when, right? Before Twitter, importantly, before Facebook, before any of this stuff. And, you know, I was a fairly young man then, but I remember it happening. And no one cared, as far as I could tell. There probably were some people, probably were some angry old men somewhere or something going, this is an outrage. Probably not. I mean, I think most people like me just thought, well, it's Eurovision. It's always quite camp. This is the campest one yet. But it wasn't a big deal, I don't remember. The fact that a trans woman from Israel as well. Imagine what happened today with Twitter, a trans woman
wouldn't
from Israel.
Quite be able to compute it.
It would be quite confusing for some people, wouldn't it? And then 2014, you get Conchita Wurst, right? This is the woman with the beard, as people started madly describing her, right? Because now you have got Twitter, right? Now the millennials have grown up. And I think 2014 was roughly when society started going mad, wasn't it? It was around that time. 1 year either way, maybe. But that was basically the point.
Started to accelerate, definitely.
Yeah, and the fact that people started referring to this drag act, right? It wasn't a trans woman or trans man. It was quite explicitly a drag act with a comedy name, right? Meaning sausage. And people go, this is amazing. What a breakthrough this is, because a woman with a beard has won Eurovision. It's like, it's not a woman with a beard. It's a man in a dress.
The short memories of this whole thing always fascinate me. It's like when I think it was Sam Smith congratulated himself on being the first gay man to win a Brit. He was a gay man then rather than a gay plural now, or whatever he is. But there is a lot of presenceism. We should move on. But Jan, I just want to ask you one question, because you mentioned there about the fact that Kathleen Stock is definitely going to speak, and the fact that the Students' Union in particular backed down is because of the fact that you had the university authorities kind of put some pressure on them. Also, as you say, the kind of Higher Education Freedom of Speech Bill has essentially formalised those free speech duties on students' unions. I was just wondering what you would say to the point that this is a bit of a problem from the perspective of students' unions being autonomous, being able to make their own decisions. You know, should we really be kind of leaning on students' unions to make particular decisions in certain cases, or is that kind of compromising their independence in that sense? Because that's an argument that you hear often in this.
Yeah, I mean, their autonomy, to be honest, is fairly hollow, isn't it? I mean, they're entirely dependent on the support of the university. They're not sort of campaigning against universities. They're sort of utterly dependent on their place on campus. So in that sense, I think they're part of the campus community, and they should be held to the standards of freedom of speech that but anybody else ought to be on campus in that sense, as long as it's consistent on this basic principle. I think then that's pretty fundamental.
You mentioned that Oxford has a freedom of speech rule or something?
Well, they all universities do have their own code of practice. As far as I can tell from what the Pro Vice Chancellor was saying, they've all had to have their own codes in the past set out, from which they all say they're pro free speech, as does the student union. And this is what happens all the time, isn't it? So all these organisations that effectively act against free speech say, well, obviously we're pro free speech and pro academic freedom,
but with these exceptions.
But obviously we uphold the welfare of our LGBTQ+ community. Or we stand in solidarity with. And it's completely dishonest. It relies on this traducing and this monstering of the individual who wants to speak or has been invited to speak. Maybe she doesn't want to speak anymore, but she's going to. And it also relies on this kind of construction of this particularly vulnerable student group whose welfare will be threatened by some words taking place on campus that they need not hear. And that's the kind of bogus claims that are being made. So I think anything that overturns that. I mean, we've launched this MacTaggart program very recently, which is designed to support students who do want to pursue open debate on campus. And we launched it, and within a day of us sort of gearing ourselves up to administer this fund, we had a kind of emergency application in from a feminist society at Bristol, who were trying to run a seminar of women lawyers, including Akua Reindorf, who's a very eminent KC, and a number of other eminent women lawyers.
One of the organisers wrote about their experience for Spikes recently.
Right.
Sounds ridiculous.
Yes, that's right. Yes, Raquel. So and so we were able to, and one of the demands that was made of them by the university or the student union was that they provide security. And so we were able to fund that, and then the meeting went ahead. And so that's happened as well at Cambridge this week. So another student, Charlie Bentley-Astor, was wanting to show a film at Cambridge. You may have covered this in Spiked as well, I'm not sure. The university said that she had to be able to deal with protesters against the showing of her own of the film that she wanted to show. And so she initially thought, okay, well, I'll take them at face value and do this, provided a risk assessment, applied to us for some money to help fund security, which we then granted. And then they said, well, actually, no, in the process of you supplying us with a risk assessment, we realise that this protest is going to be beyond your control, and therefore we can't allow this event to go ahead. And you think, well, how can you possibly, as the organiser event, take responsibility for the lunatics who want to shut you down?
What was the film?
It's a film about the fertility crisis.
What's wrong with that?
Well, exactly. Well, the guy who made it has had a conversation with Jordan Peterson at some point, so that was seen to be extremely dangerous. And it's partly targeted at Charlie herself, I think, because she's raised her head above the parapet before. So, I mean, absolutely admirable. Yeah.
People build up a certain... But it's a good reminder that as people have been involved in this debate for a very long time, as soon as you concede the principle on this stuff, it was just going to spread. I mean, no platform for fascists has become no platform for feminists in a pretty zippy period of time. I think it was Julie Bindle first got no platform about 2011 or something. It's incredible. But we should move on and talk about some other nanny state issues, Chris. Since we last spoke, we spoke a little bit last time about George Osborne being dredged up from wherever it is that he hangs out these days. One of many jobs to say that he thought that it was time to ban smoking. Since then, we've had Wes Streeting, Shadow Health Secretary, renew his call for smoking to be banned in the UK. And you wrote about this for Spikes. You kind of made the point that this is almost slightly unusual for the Labour Party because they're trying not to scare the horses about anything. They don't believe in anything. They don't have any policies. But on this, he said it a couple of times about being slapped down. Do you think this could actually happen? We get a Labour government and we get prohibition of smoking somewhere along the line.
Yes, I think it's quite possible. And we don't know what we're going to get with a Labour government, do we? I mean, we really don't. I mean, it's not a novel observation, but, you know, Keir Starmer blatantly lied to the membership to become leader. He said he was a big socialist. Now he's saying he's basically Tony Blair. Is he, which is he, you know? Maybe he's neither of them. Maybe he's, I don't know what he is. Nobody really does. And I imagine that'll be the main Tory attack line come the general election if they've got any competence at all. So we don't know what's going to happen. But as I said in that Spikes article, they're not going to have any money, so they're not going to be able to do a Tony Blair-type splurge on the NHS and education. They're really only left with sort of identity politics-type stuff, which I suspect Keir Starmer will be steering clear of. And I don't think he's going to be, you know, bending the knee or anything between now and the election or after the election if he wins. So it really leaves things like these nanny state policies. You know, if you want to make your mark and show that you've done something, this is why nanny state policies are so popular with politicians, because
it's a legacy.
They don't have a vision. They don't have a lot of, you know, they don't really know where they're going with things. It gives you a legacy, right? So the George Osborne, good example, right? His legacy, he was Chancellor for 6 years, but the thing he wants to be his legacy seems to be the sugar tax.
Making chocolate a bit more
expensive.
Didn't
even work.
Or smaller.
Yeah, right. Tony Blair's legacy, even though he left power a week before it happened, was a smoking ban. You know, he went for the full smoking ban precisely because he knew he needed a legacy, which wasn't going to be the Iraq War. Right? So these things, controversial though they may be, they appeal to politicians. They're cheap, if not, I mean, in the case of the sugar tax, actually make money from it. They get a lot of publicity, and you get a big pat on the back from the likes of the World Health Organization, all the public health groups. So prohibition tobacco obviously is a major, you know, leap forward from the kind of anti-tobacco regulation we've had for years. But the Kiwis are going ahead. We've talked about this before. Their mad idea of taking all the nicotine out of cigarettes and drastically reducing the number of places you can buy them and raising the age at which you can buy them. And once one country does a stupid thing like this, other countries just queue up to copy them. Now, I'm pretty sure that the New Zealand plan will be a huge catastrophe, really. But they are a better place than anybody else to deal with it being an island in the middle of nowhere. And it's only 5 million people, only about 12%, something like that, smoke. Still, I think you will have a huge black market and all kinds of problems. But will it happen? I mean, if it's obviously a disaster, no, it won't happen. But the fact that he's said this twice now, I thought he'd be shouted down the first time.
Yeah.
George Osborne's little, you know, idea didn't go down very well, as far as I could tell, with the general public. Even non-smokers who couldn't care less about all the rest of it, the tobacco taxes, the plain packaging, graphic warnings, they don't care about that. Why should they? Even they don't want to lose £12 billion tax revenue. Even they, most of them at least, think, well, I don't smoke, but that doesn't mean nobody else should. But it is very interesting that this is the one policy, really, that's come up more than once from Streeting. And he clearly is very drawn to it and doesn't have any ethical objections to it whatsoever. His objections purely are practical. Will it work? Let's see how it works in New Zealand. But if it is seen to work, or at least not backfire enormously, I think he'll be very tempted to do it, because the eyes of the world will be on Britain. We're leading the way, tobacco control, blah, 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 blah. And the rights of millions of people just don't seem to come into it.
Jan, I imagine that the Free Speech Union doesn't have an official position on smoking prohibition, but speaking in a personal capacity, what did you make of this particular policy being floated by the Labour Party?
Well, I mean, the thing is, at a symbolic level, I can imagine it seems like a safe bet, actually, because I think so few people have got arguments to their fingertips against authoritarian measures, including young people, who many of whom smoke. I mean, I almost, you can sort of imagine nowadays smokers themselves arguing for the restriction of smoking because it makes it easier for them to smoke less. And there's these kinds of arguments that just seem to have become embedded. I mean, I've got an older teenager living at home, and whenever his friends come around, the thing that I find on the floor afterwards is always those little filters and then tobacco on the table. That's how I can work out how many people have been around my house when I'm out. but at the same time, I can also imagine them not being equipped with any arguments as to why they might defend smoking, because they sort of don't really make the distinction between law and things you're not allowed to do, or things you shouldn't do, or things it would be better not to do. And there's just this kind of flabby world into which, politicians can speak. And I don't really think they're met with much opposition. I mean, I was thinking today, I buy one packet of cigarettes a year before I go on my summer holidays.
Do your bit for the exchequer.
Well, each time I do it, the theatricality has increased. It's become like a Catholic mass now. Whereas I used to just kind of be shocked at the price. And I think the last time I bought a packet last year, I tried to buy a packet of menthol cigarettes, which is what I normally want. You can't buy them anymore, which is what? Because they're too appealing to people who don't really like the taste of cigarettes, which would be me. And so I can no longer get a Marlboro menthol.
So did you not buy cigarettes?
No, I did buy cigarettes.
Exactly.
But then they had.
That's how the law works. Well, then, you can't have menthol cigarettes. Go, okay, I'll have some normal cigarettes.
Then they lift. Then
they don't say, oh, okay, that'll go home. Yeah, you look really.
But they lifted up the grey blind, and then I couldn't tell which packet was which, because they've all got pictures of goiters and whatever, hideous holes on people's faces on the front. And I was trying to direct the shopkeeper to a particular packet, guessing at what it might be. And he had no idea what they were either. So the whole thing is just a ridiculous kind of charade. And yet there's clearly some demand for it, because they're still there right behind the counter in the supermarket or the shop, So
why don't you buy cigarettes when you're on holiday, where they're cheaper?
Oh, because I don't
go to Iceland.
No, because there's a ritual. I used to buy them at the Eurotunnel terminal. You see, it was always kind of part of heading abroad. And during COVID, when I wasn't going abroad, I bought them domestically anyway. So I eke them out.
I think that point about the sort of self-loathing younger smokers, I've definitely run into that a few times with people that say, well, we probably shouldn't be doing this anyway. You think, what's wrong with you?
But you get that with people who smoke cannabis and take drugs. It's not like they don't all want to legalise drugs. A lot of them think they should be legalised. Not all of them, by any means. Yeah. Possibly not even a majority.
Mm. Very, very strange. But Chris, you were talking a bit there about the New Zealand model, as I'm sure it will soon be referred to as. So in terms of, we say, banning smoking, banning cigarettes, what would this actually look like? I'm not sure if Labour put much meat on the bone in terms of what it is that they do and how they do it, but how, if they were to properly go ahead with prohibition, what do you think it would look like? Would it be staged? I know that New Zealand had this kind of escalator towards...
Yeah, but that was a bit of a red herring, really. I mean, the real prohibition in New Zealand is they're taking the nicotine out of cigarettes, right? And people are not really going to smoke cigarettes if they've got nicotine.
So what are you left with? Paper and dust?
You're left.
It's the opposite of e-cigarettes, right? E-cigarettes are harm reduction, right? You get rid of the stuff that kills you and you leave in the bit that doesn't kill you and people enjoy it, right? And with New Zealand, they're doing exactly the opposite. They're taking out the harmless thing that people smoke them for and leaving in all the stuff that kills you. Thinking quite rightly that people actually won't really bother smoking. It's like alcohol-free beer. Most people are not going to keep drinking it. And you would certainly call it prohibition if the only beer you could get was alcohol-free beer. So that's the prohibition. The sliding scale of age purchase is irrelevant, really. So I think that's how they do it, because they would probably still claim that we're not prohibiting anything. We're just regulating. We're just removing the nicotine or taking it to non-addictive levels, whatever that means, basically like trace amounts of nicotine. So maybe some people will carry on smoking and vaping at the same time or something, or put a nicotine pouch in. But they're already talking about banning vaping when they finish with that, I'm already resigned at the age of 46 to having whatever nicotine products I use when I'm, you know, 60 or so, illegal. I'm just kind of resigned to the fact that everything's just going to go to the black market. And maybe that's not such a bad thing. You know what I mean? I mean, cigarettes will be cheaper for smokers. We're in a black market. They are now. They're way, way cheaper. I don't understand why anyone really buys cigarettes in this country unless you're doing it as a ritual once a year. You know, but like, you can go abroad and
fake tan and a packet of fags.
Yeah. I mean, it's still more it's more difficult now we've left the EU. But when we're in the EU, yeah, you could literally pay for your entire holiday by bringing back cigarettes if you're a 20-a-day smoker. So, I don't think anybody has any moral responsibility to obey the law on this, I have to say. I mean, I think all smokers should be buying on the black market, frankly, because the government is treating them like scum and is extorting from them and then using the money to vilify them.
We need some pro-smoking, civil disobedience, and law-breaking. But Jan, Chris made this point in his piece, but maybe it's worth touching on a little bit here, which is that... it's not as if the Tory party had been particularly good on these lifestyle issues. Sugar tax, we've already heard about, didn't roll back any of these things. You had a kind of brief period under Liz Truss and to a lesser extent Boris Johnson where they tried to sound a little less pro-nanny state. But is there something particular about the Labour Party who seem preoccupied with this politics of lifestyle, do you think? Is it something that kind of, for whatever reason, is more kind of hardwired into them? Because obviously the last new Labour government, not just the smoking ban, but in general, the kind of rise of sort of nanny state policies was pretty significant, I think.
Well, I think I suppose the Labour Party never talks about choice because they don't really believe that any of us make them. So if people are poor, they think that the choices they make are all kind of determined from outside of that, of them, their own lives. And so they find it, I think they do find it difficult to conceive of people as making choices. So in that sense, you can't defend choice if you don't believe that it's actually happening. And that kind of seems to come across in all kinds of ways. I think there's also that gatekeeper mentality of the health service. You know, why would you do something that costs our NHS money, takes away from more deserving people, and especially given that a lot of people, well, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because, you know, a lot of people who might vote Labour would work within the NHS, and there's always been that kind of slightly self-righteous kind of gatekeeper mentality there. But then equally, you know, obviously people who work in the NHS are eat as many cakes as the next person and probably smoke as well. So I don't know quite how they fit into the picture, but certainly kind of officially the sort of view that that choice is really not really a thing. It's not something that really matters to people and doesn't really exist. It's just been there for a really long time now.
That very consciously kind of paternalistic relationship with the working class in particular, which they've developed, seems pretty strong at this point. But we should move on to artificial sweeteners, Chris, which you wanted to talk about today. So I believe that WHO have come out with some research suggesting that maybe they're not all they're cracked up to be as far as people switching from a Coke to a Coke Zero to try and lose weight. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about this?
Yeah, it didn't get as much news coverage as I thought it would, actually. I mean, it was reported a bit. But yeah, the WHO on Monday came out and said that our guidelines now for artificial sweeteners are that you shouldn't use them at all for you know, if you're hoping to kind of maintain a healthy weight or lose weight. They don't work and they may indeed be dangerous and may be linked to preterm births and various forms of cancer and all this kind of stuff, which is a bit of a U-turn, another U-turn from the WHO, because the WHO, along with, you know, the likes of Public Health England, have been spending the last few years telling the food industry to reformulate their sugary products and put artificial sweeteners in them. And now, if they're to be believed, what they've been recommending is at best useless and at worst positively dangerous for public health. What's the evidence for this? Well, I mean, you need to remember the WHO is, you know, is not the final word on these things. They're not like a Cochrane review. You know, and people, you know, kind of a lot of people at least respect the WHO and see it as a great authority on these things, but it's actually not. When it's talking about these lifestyle issues, particularly if there's any kind of scientific controversy, the WHO just pick a side and then they get whichever side they've picked to write a report to support what they're saying. And I think in this instance, their sort of systematic review and report has been written by people who really are just purists, just don't think anyone should consume anything that's sweet. And they literally
nice
say
or
that
the, tasty.
The, well, the WHO just say people need to stop having a taste for sweet things, yeah, in so many words. Just drink
it's really
water.
Quite simple when you think.
Yeah, and if you must have, if you do feel a taste for sweet things, have an apple. I mean, this is more or less what they're saying. So yeah, they've got these Puritans involved, and they also these guys think that artificial sweeteners are ultra processed food, which you talked about in the last episode. So they're against them, and because they're against them, they're basically saying they're totally useless. Now, are they totally useless? Well, the evidence, it has to be said, is pretty sketchy on these things. But that's mainly because nutritional epidemiology is absolute garbage. It's a complete cesspool of contradictory junk observations. It's pathetic when you consider how many decades, you know, how much money has been put into public health research over the years. They can't answer the simplest questions. And this is a really simple question, right? Do artificial sweeteners compared to sugar help you lose weight? Obviously, on the face of it, they haven't got any calories. You would think they would do. There is a view, as expressed not by none other than Donald Trump, that they just make you hungry. I've heard quite a few people, even like scientists, say it's quite possible it sort of stimulates the appetite in some way, which would explain it if they don't work. But I think the bottom line is we don't know. The WHO report is, you know, like I said, it's another U-turn. Were they right last year or are they right now? Who really knows? The main point, I think, is that we can have these, you know, debates and we can read about it in the paper that science has changed yet again. But because the science changes so often and these people really don't know what they're talking about, we shouldn't be basing any kind of public policy on it. It's way too risky to be having population level interventions in the food supply based on science that could easily change next week.
I'm not sure if you've got a particular point to make about artificial sweeteners, Jen, but before...
Surprisingly, I have. I didn't know I had of you. I suppose I would understand this as in the context of just this disorientation that we've undergone when it comes to food. And this sounds really trite, but I do take every public health pronouncement headline with a pinch of salt. You know, it's. I mean, I read the Times every day, and there's just always these kind of stories. This is what you should do to reach the age of 80, or this is what you should do. And, you know, you read, and luckily, if you read the comments underneath, people are incredibly sceptical about all this stuff now, because we've lived long enough to see the instability in the claims that are made. But I do think the disorientation is a really unfortunate effect. And I suspect things like, you know, you have a sweetened, like a Diet Coke or something, or diet drink, and you think, oh, I've had a diet drink, so therefore I can compensate by eating more of food. In the same way, if I go for a run, if I believed what the fitness tracker tells me in terms of calories, I would eat a massive breakfast after a run. But I know that actually that's, you know, it's bullshit, the kind of it. So
is it? What's bullshit?
Well, the level of the number of calories they say that you use in a run.
Is it an exaggeration?
Yeah. That's what we all do. We all kind of overcompensate and then think, okay, now I can have a huge breakfast. And it's so shocking when you realize how few calories you can actually consume as you get older. But this kind of disorienting effect, though. I had this interesting little scenario the day I was on the train, and there was these grandparents with a, you know, lovely little three-year-old granddaughter with them. And, you know, the grandmother's just continually kind of exhorting her to drink water, which is obviously this idea that somehow we become desiccated if we don't drink water.
Very new one, that as well.
It is really. Well, I don't know, it goes back 20 odd years or something.
Constantly drinking water.
There's a great Jerry Seinfeld sketch about that, about us kind of just turning to dust if we don't drink. But then the other thing was they tried to then give her a snack. And what they produced as a snack was this strange kind of object that looked nothing like food. It was a kind of fruit. I think they're fruit winders or something like that. They're like a kind of compressed fruit in a roll. It's like a sticky sweet thing. But I presume it had been supplied by the child's mother as a healthy alternative to a biscuit. But the grandparents didn't know how to administer this food to the three-year-old. So they gave her the whole thing. And then they were sort of saying, I don't think she should have the whole thing because it obviously looks like a sweet. So it's like giving her Haribo or something. And I thought, oh God, if they'd just had a biscuit, it would have been so much more simple because they would know what a biscuit was and how many, generally speaking, it's sensible for a three-year-old to have. But they're just, obviously, the mother is thinking along completely different lines based on health advice. And then I've read that these things are really bad for your teeth because they're incredibly sticky. Right. They stick in children's teeth.
It's a process as well, isn't it?
Bete noir of yours.
Well, even raisins. You know, dentists were saying a few years ago that, you know, kids would be encouraged to eat raisins and their teeth were suffering as a result because they get stuck in all the nooks and crannies of their teeth. Yeah. So they may not be eating Haribo, but they are eating something else, which is just basically sugar. So, you know, we just somehow we need to rediscover just really kind of quite normal common sense reactions to food. But I don't know how we go back to that.
We should, we're fast running out of time, but I want to squeeze in a couple of questions
from the postbag.
Postbag.
It's bulging, eh?
Do you sing that?
Yeah, I do, actually.
He recorded it, yeah. There's a question here for you, Chris, which we haven't answered for months. So it's from a gentleman called Barry Curtis.
Hi, Barry.
Sorry, it's taken so long, mate. In defending consumer freedom, are you saying, Chris, that multi-buy offers and ruthless advertising are themselves non-coercive? If so, why do they even exist?
It's a bit of a non sequitur, isn't it? I mean, they're not coercive because they don't coerce you. I notice the advertising people don't like is always aggressive or ruthless or whatever, you know. And it's not really, it's just advertising and most people ignore it. And it doesn't really work in the way that a lot of people think it does. So no, it's not coercive, any of these offers. I mean, an offer almost by definition cannot be coercive. The clue's in the name, I would say. That's the other trope you get about advertising. If it didn't work, why would they do it? Why would they spend so many billions of pounds on it? And the answer is really simple. It's well, it comes from a misunderstanding of what the purpose of advertising is. So people who don't like, let's say, sugary drink advertising or alcohol advertising, say alcohol advertising, right? So the Budweiser, when they do their adverts, they're not trying to get people to drink more alcohol. If they drink more alcohol, that's fine. If they drink more beer, even better. But really, they want them to drink more Budweiser. And the same with all their competitors. And also the same with things like Andrex toilet tissue or Felix the cat food, right? Very obviously, they're not advertising cat food to sell more cat food overall to the population, right? They're not advertising more to Andrex toilet paper so people use more toilet paper. It's not going to happen. It's a static market. They just want you to buy Andrex rather than something else, right? And Felix rather than Whiskers. And it's exactly the same with Budweiser versus Birra Moretti. So the idea in public health is that advertising increases the sale of the entire category, and therefore alcohol advertising increases people overall consumption of alcohol. It's empirically untrue, because if you look at the amount of money spent on alcohol over time, it doesn't bear any relation to the amount of alcohol that's consumed. But it does bear relation to the amount of Budweiser consumed if Budweiser suddenly start doing a massive campaign. So no, Barry, I don't think these things are at all coercive. What I think is coercive is banning them. I think that's very coercive. And the reason that companies do them isn't to coerce people or even to lift sales of the products overall. It's just to increase their market share at the expense of somebody else's.
I could only hope that was worth the wait, Barry. But Jan, we've got a question which isn't directly aimed at you, but I think is essentially. So this is from your former colleagues at the Centre for Parenting Culture Studies at the University of Kent, who have flagged up this story about baby formula prices and whether or not they could spark a public health crisis. Is a story in Sky, essentially. Will there be a situation where people actually have to steal baby formula? And is this a big public health issue we should be worried about? Have you seen this?
Yeah, I did see it. I mean, the price of baby formula is extraordinary. It's like £15 a tin, and you could be getting through one to two tins a week. And the kind of emotive aspect of this story is obviously very powerful. I mean, because you can take or leave any other foodstuff, you know, including for young children, because you can always give them something else. But baby milk is the only thing that baby's having, or it's the only drink they're having if they're a bit older. But I think what the story's shown, beyond the price issue, which I think, you know, I don't think I would necessarily stick to my libertarian guns when it comes to the price of baby milk. I wouldn't. I mean, it already is a very heavily regulated product in order to make sure that it's safe. I don't necessarily have a problem with maybe making sure that it's affordable as well. However, what it's also revealed, though, is that there's all these other kinds of restrictions on it, which have turned infant formula from being a foodstuff into this very peculiar sort of item, which is on the one hand seen as a medicine. So in a hospital ward that's baby friendly, in its kind of official assignation, it has to be kept in a locked cabinet like a medicine would be. And it's also simultaneously talked about as if it's toxic or certainly suboptimal. So, you know, this is a lot of the work that we did at Kent over the years has been around infant feeding and the kind of incredible, both the medicalisation of it and the moralisation of it through a public health agenda of breast is best, which, you know, has just proved to be incredibly unhelpful for women having to make really practical decisions about how to feed babies. So, you know, I think the fact that at least this conversation about cost shows infant formula to be something that it actually is, which is an essential foodstuff for babies. And it's also indicated just the extent to which babies in Britain are formula fed. You know, vast majority of them within the first few months are fed either exclusively by formula or as a mixed feeding with breastfeeding. So the, you know, this kind of fantasy that women would somehow become in Britain would become these kind of fanatical breastfeeders has just not materialised, as it never was going to, because it's just really quite impractical to breastfeed a baby for a long period of time. It doesn't go with the life of women who are raising other children or working or just struggling to do the physical act of feeding a baby. So, you know, I think in some ways, at least there's this kind of campaign around this issue focuses attention on formula as a very, very important foodstuff that needs to, we need to make sure there's supply. Need to make sure it's affordable. I mean, there was even stories a year or so ago about food banks refusing to supply formula. It's already the case that people can't use bog-off deals on formula. You can't pick up loyalty points on formula.
Can't advertise it.
No, you can't advertise it. You can't show a baby drinking it. So this is why you have this.
It's insanely overregulated, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. I hate these breast Nazis, and I hope the midwifery department of Worthing Hospital are listening to this, because they make people's lives a misery for no reason at all. It's just this stupid, hippie-ish rubbish, combined with, like, there is a genuine issue in, like, Africa, you know, where people haven't got clean drinking water and they mix the milk powder with that, right? That's the only issue with
the drinking water, yeah.
It's the drinking water that's a problem. It's not the milk powder. And, you know, I don't know if babies are already dying because of this crusade, but, it's not far off. It's completely unscientific, certainly in the Western world where we have clean drinking water. And the solution in the third world is to get clean drinking water in. It's just a stupid, it's not even a fad because it's been going on so long, but there's just nothing wrong with it. And yeah, it's hugely overregulated. It's expensive now because there's a shortage in America, right?
That was due to a contamination issue in 2022. And I think that was resolved.
Everyone needs to get over it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Dan, one final question. Taking to asking it of our guests, given this is quite a libertarian podcast, if you had one ban, what would it be? And it's got to be something really kind of petty. I think Chris picked wheelie suitcases. Mark Littlewood picked British football commentary. So things of that nature. You can't ban hate or anything particularly worthy like that.
Well, if you ask my family, they'd say I'm the most judgy, intolerant person, especially to live with. Although I do spend most of my life wheeling a wheelie suitcase around.
Everyone does, apart from me.
People involved in campaigns tend to. God, what do I hate? I know what it is. I would ban people from taking photographs in front of pieces of art in art galleries. I went to the Musée d'Orsay last summer, and you queued to get to the front in order to see Van Gogh. And then I just stood there and sort of spread my elbows out so that nobody could get beside me or in front of me to take pictures of the artworks. It makes absolutely no sense.
It's like they're going to go home and stare at this photo.
It's really bizarre. When you could buy a postcard of it in the shop on the way out and actually look at it with your eyes while you're standing in front of it, I really, really don't get it. And I don't understand why the galleries tolerate it.
It's a great point to end on. Chris, Jan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.